Okay, I will call the Jobs and Agriculture Committee to order, Rural Development. Today we do have a quorum, and we only have one bill on the agenda today, Senate File 1603. And Senator Sparks, would you like to speak to the bill?
Mr. Chair and members, first of all, thank you for your patience. I know it's a busy time of year, and we're trying to find a time to fit this hearing in. So thank you for being flexible and allowing us to start a little late. I know that we do have a few members that are in the Finance Committee, but I think we'll go ahead and get started with this important piece of legislation. I'm sure that members will be coming and going as we move forward. Senate File 1603, Mr. Chairman and members, is the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council recommendations adaption that we're going to be dealing with today. And before we get started, I do have the A1 author's amendment that I would like to offer that would put the bill in the shape the author would prefer and part of the agreement that was reached between the business and labor. So if I could offer that.
Okay, Senator Sparks would like to move the A1 amendment to get it in the shape and the form that he would like, and this is the first committee hearing. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. And Senator Sparks, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. With the A1 now part of the bill, what we have before you is the work product of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. This council, as many of you know, is made up of business and labor and has worked hard to come to this agreement on the changes in the bill that represent updates to the system that help injured workers and create some needed reform within the system. Deputy Commissioner Chris Iden from the Department of Labor and Industry is here with me, and I'd like her to have her walk through the provisions of the bill for you. Then we'll hear from representatives from labor and business who served on the council about the agreement. Perhaps as a group, then we can answer questions about the bill. I know there are some other people who would like to testify after that, but if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner at this time.
Okay, and welcome, Deputy Commissioner Iden, and if you could state your name for the record. And
thank you.
Continue.
My name is Chris Iden, and I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. And what I'd like to do is just go through the bill briefly, section by section. Section 1 of the bill provides coverage for post-traumatic stress disorder, and it does that by amending the definition of occupational disease. Section 2 is very similar. There, the definition of personal injury is amended to include coverage for post-traumatic stress disorder. Section 3 deals with attorney's fees, and it raises a cap on attorney's fees from $13,000 to $26,000. It's somewhat of an artificial cap because attorneys can always petition the court for additional fees, but now they'd have to petition the court if they want more than $26,000 in fees. Section 4 pertains to attorney fee reimbursement, and under current law, an insurance company is required to reimburse an employee if the attorney's fees. They've got to reimburse the employee 30% of any attorney's fees over $250. But sometimes the employee doesn't pay attorney's fees. For example, if there are only medical or rehabilitation issues in dispute, the employee wouldn't pay any attorney's fees. Under current law, the insurer would still be required to reimburse the employee for fees. So this amendment would remove that anomaly. Section 5 pertains to an increase in maximum benefits, and this amendment will increase the maximum weekly benefit from a flat $850 to 102% of the statewide average weekly wage. Section 6 deals with job development limits, and it's a very narrow part of job development that is at issue. It's those functions that include contacting prospective employers, identifying job openings, and arranging interviews. And those services will be limited to 20 hours per month and will last for 3 months, at which time the parties would have to agree to continue them, or they'd have to go to the Department of Labor and Industry or OAH and have them extended for an additional 3 months. Section 7 pertains to disability case management, and it would preclude a QRC, a qualified rehabilitation consultant, from providing disability case management services on behalf of an insurer, and then providing that same employee statutory rehab services. There could be a conflict of interest in those situations. Section 8 puts rehabilitation conferences on the fast track, and the amendment would require the department or OAH to hold a rehab conference within 21 days of the request. Section 9 pertains to how prevailing charges are determined. And under the law, hospitals are reimbursed either 85% of their usual and customary fees or 85% of the prevailing charge. Prevailing charge is determined by taking 20 examples of at least 20 of the bills of the same service over a period of 1 year. So an insurer could establish its own database of prevailing charges by gathering bills, at least 20, over a year. For some unique services, it's hard to do that, and so this amendment would extend the period of time over which these services can be billed to 2 years. So the data would be based on 2 years' worth of information. Section 10 pertains to COLA, and it does three things. First, it increases the cap on cost of living adjustments from 2% to 3%. It states that there's no adjustment if the COLA is less than zero, and it changes the date on which COLA benefits are triggered from the fourth anniversary to the third anniversary of the injury. Section 11 gives the authority to the commissioner to adopt rules that would require employees to enter into a contract with their treating physician if they're being prescribed narcotics for the long-term treatment of pain. That's currently the medical standard, that there be this agreement between a treating physician and an employee, but the current law doesn't give the commissioner the authority to require that. Section 12 requires the department to set up a pilot program for 2 years where we would establish a patient advocate to help and assist injured workers that have back injuries and or are considering spinal fusions. And then the last section is a reimbursement cost study that the department will be conducting before the end of the year with regard to reforms and barriers with respect to workers' comp costs and reducing those and administrative costs. The department would have to report its findings and recommendations to the Workers' Comp Advisory Council by the end of the year. And that's the Reader's Digest version of the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Iden. And any questions before we move on to testifiers?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. First, as it relates to the increase in the attorney's fees, if there is a process by which they can charge more than the $13,000, why are we making this adjustment, if I might ask?
And Deputy Commissioner Iden.
Mr. Chair, Senator, this change, the cap on attorney's fees hasn't been changed for, I think, since 1992. And the amendment recognizes that costs and fees have gone up, and it also would limit the amount of petitions that are heard at the Office of Administrative Hearings to increase the amount of attorney's fees.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Weber.
When you say that, I mean, what are we talking about as far as how many cases, percentage-wise, probably get petitioned?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have that percentage.
One other question, if I might ask, with the change that's being made from a maximum of 850 to 102%, as of current numbers, what are we actually talking about as far as dollar and cents are concerned?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, currently 102% of the statewide average weekly wage is about $934. So you would be looking at an immediate increase of about $84.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? And Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Iden, if you could tell me, can you give us an estimated cost of what this is going to cost business or workers' compensation, what these additional costs are going to add up to in total? Do you have any idea?
Deputy Commissioner Iden.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have a number. I can attest to the fact, though, that the negotiations between labor and business were very a number of provisions were hotly debated. The idea was there would be benefit increases and there would be cost savings. What that nets out to, I don't have a specific number.
Well, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Daines.
Follow up. Will that be some information? I guess I'd ask this to the author of the bill. Is that some information that maybe some other testifiers will have for us in their testimony?
Senator Sparks?
Mr. Chair and Senator Daines, I certainly think that they would be able to help out. We would obviously welcome the opportunity for you to ask those folks that were part of the internal negotiations more.
Okay. In response to this, thank you. In response to the Senator's previous question, the increases that are represented in the bill were estimated to increase cost to the whole workers' comp system by about 1.2% to 1.4%. Now, that doesn't give any effect to the cost savings, but that would be the amount of increased cost that the benefit increases would result in.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions?
Just one further question,
Senator Daines.
On this particular subject. I'm assuming this is a bill that did not come from your department. Is that correct, Ms. Iden?
Deputy Commissioner Iden.
Mr. Chair, Senator, this bill was negotiated by labor and business and was approved by and recommended by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. And the department's charge is to advocate and work on its passage.
And so,
Senator Daines.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Does that mean then that the department supports this bill in its entirety, or are there issues, areas where you feel there are some issues that we still need to do some work on?
Deputy Commissioner Iden.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't think it's a perfect bill, but we do support it in its entirety.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Daines.
Deputy Commissioner Iden, can you tell me the areas that are imperfect?
Deputy Commissioner Iden.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure in this room there would be a person that could have an issue with every one of the sections. I think it's a good bill. I don't think we should give up the good in striving for perfection, but I can't tell you which provisions.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Thank you.
So, any further questions? Okay, seeing none, those on the list for testifying, Shar Knutson, the President of the Minnesota AFL-CIO.
Mr. Chairman, maybe as they come up to the table, just I think in your packets you do have letters of support from David Olson, the President of the Minnesota Chamber, and also from the SEIU showing support for the Advisory Council's work.
Welcome, Ms. Knutson, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Shar Knutson, and I'm president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, a federation of over 1,000 union locals representing more than 300,000 working men and women across the state. So thank you for the opportunity to speak with the committee this morning. Minnesota's workers' compensation law was passed in 1913. That's a long time ago. In simple terms, it said if a worker is hurt on the job, that worker will receive the care and the support that they need. In return, the company will not be sued. So the way we see it, there are really two stakeholders in this conversation, the injured workers and the company that they work for. In 1992, the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, called WCAC, was created by the state legislature as a permanent council to address and recommend legislation pertaining to workers' compensation. And this was an attempt to remove the very divisive workers' compensation battles that had taken place at the state legislature off and on the 10 previous years. It is based on a similar council that had operated in Wisconsin for many, many years. So for those of you who might not know, the WCAC consists of 12 voting members, 6 representing organized labor, and 6 representing Minnesota businesses. 10 of those are appointed by the governor, the majority and minority leaders in the Senate, and by the speaker and the minority leaders of the House of Representatives. The other two members are presidents of the largest statewide Minnesota business organization and the largest organized labor association, hence Minnesota's Chamber of Commerce and the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and we are co-chairs of the WCAC. The Advisory Council recommendations must be supported by a majority of both business and labor members. At the April 10, 2013 meeting of the WCAC, the labor and business agreement was passed unanimously. And now, we would all have preferred to get this agreement to you at a sooner time. Today is the result of several months of hard-fought negotiations. After the compromise was passed in the WCAC on April 10th, business and labor members of the council were approached with some concerns. And while we didn't agree on all the concerns that were expressed, we did decide to make minor modifications to the compromise. The changes to the agreement have been vetted and approved by both labor and business WCAC members, as well as the Department of Labor and Industry, and this was all via in-person contact with phone or mail. And I can say that the 75 members of the Minnesota AFL-CIO's General Board unanimously voted to support the Labor Business WCAC agreement of April 16, 2013. We believe it is a good bill. It's not a perfect bill, but then I would ask, have you ever seen a perfect bill? This is a good bill, a bill agreed by the WCAC. And it's the most comprehensive agreement we've had in nearly 20 years. It's a fair agreement that will improve the lives of injured workers and take serious steps to realize cost savings. So it's really the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for injured workers, for business, and the workers' compensation system. So I respectfully ask for your support of the legislation representing the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council compromise. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Knutson. And we also have in favor of the bill, Ms. Laura Bordelon, Senior Vice President of Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. So welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Laura Bordelon with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'm here today on behalf of David Olson, the president of our organization, who is a co-chair with Ms. Knutson of the Workforce Advisory Council. Our organization not only supports the agreement, we think it's an important compromise, but we also want to speak strongly in support of the workforce, the Work Comp Advisory Council. We think the process is incredibly important for resolving differences between business and labor regarding worker benefits and business concerns. It's been a successful process over a long period of time. We think that this agreement is a result of the effectiveness of that process. In addition to expressing our support for the agreement and the Work Comp Advisory Council process, I want to thank the author for assisting us with this bill, as well as the staff at Dolly, both Commissioner Peterson and Assistant Commissioner Iden, for their great work in supporting the Work Comp Advisory Council efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bordelon. And any questions for either of our testifiers here? Okay, seeing none, we can move on to, thank you very much. Move on to testimony and opposition. We have some testifiers. Robin Sykes, Minnesota Counties Intergovernmental Trust. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senators. My name is Robin Sykes, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Counties Intergovernmental Trust, and I really do appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation with you today. I would point out that having these conversations either at the House or the Senate really are very important to us because as public entities, we are not offered a voice at the WCAC. Public entities are excluded from that. During the last week, I've been very happy to learn that there has been some discussion and some modifications that were of issue to MCIT, particularly relative to who could make the findings of the PTSD diagnosis.
While this, I think, does improve the bill, I am here asking that you consider a couple of other changes that I think will help clarify other aspects of the legislation and address concerns, one of those being of the most and most likely significantly impacted groups, and that's the taxpayers in the state of Minnesota. According to Deed, Minnesota had approximately 384,000 public employees in March of this year. Costs associated with maintaining this workforce is borne totally by taxpayers in the state of Minnesota, and that includes the cost of the workers' compensation benefits that are paid to them. I'm here representing 81 of Minnesota's 87 counties and about 350 other public entities, which equates to about 26,000 of those public employees. This bill is particularly onerous to municipalities like my counties, simply because of the fact that our employees are mandated to perform some of the riskiest jobs in the state of Minnesota. We're talking law enforcement, jail administration, highway maintenance, snow plowing, social services, public health, and even property appraisals. While I'm here to encourage you to amend the bill to limit the cost to taxpayers, the language I'm proposing may actually expedite benefits to employees who sustain PTSD diagnosis for a work-related trauma by reducing potential litigation that will be necessary by virtue of the fact of some of the lack of clarity in this particular legislation. MCIT believes it is absolutely imperative that the PTSD diagnosis arise out of extraordinary and unusual conditions compared to the normal conditions of employment. The current language requires that a municipality, one of my counties, cover a claim of stress related to traumatic events that did not occur at work, but are simply triggered by work. For example, a child is involved in a car accident that kills a family member. Years later, that individual is employed as a deputy sheriff and comes across a fatal accident that involves a family. The event that is typical for the profession, because we can expect that law enforcement officers will come across accidents, triggers reactions that eventually result in a diagnosis of PTSD. In this example, the county is going to be responsible for that work comp, even though the event was not out of the ordinary for that type of that individual performing that task. Our proposal requires that the traumatic event at the root of the employee's PTSD be specifically related to the workplace. I don't see this benefit. This benefit should only be for those very extreme and unusual situations. It should be for the exceptions, not the rule. Our proposed language would distinguish and actually support a claim for work comp benefits when the event that is the root cause of the PTSD occurs while that employee is working for us as the municipality. For example, and I think some of the genesis of this claim comes from the Red Lake shooting. For example, you have a teacher who expects to encounter fights, arguments, sick kids, bullying, and other incidents, but these are incidental and usual. But encountering massacred children at a school is an extraordinary event that probably would result in a PTSD diagnosis, and we don't have an issue with that. They are working for us. It is extreme. It is out of the ordinary. The current language will increase the exposure for claims and cause protracted litigation. As a result, municipalities will have to pay more for work comp, which will most likely be translated to taxpayers. We also emphasize the need that you remove the phrase "in good faith" from the proposed language. In good faith creates a gray area that will need to litigation, which will increase the cost of the claims. Anyone who has ever been involved in employment claims knows that this type of litigation is very fact-specific, will require protracted litigation, and potentially even delayed benefits to the people you are trying to help the most, the injured worker. Moreover, workers' compensation is a no-fault system, and the inclusion of this language implies someone is at fault. It totally flies in the face of the philosophy that neither the employee or employer must prove fault. And finally, this legislation is expected to have significant impact financially for municipalities, including the state, the counties, cities, townships, school districts, and therefore I believe that it requires some kind of a fiscal note so the taxpayers know what the cost of this is going to be. I can tell you I've looked at the MCIT program. We offer an EAP program for our members, and based upon that employee assistance program utilization in 2012, we estimate the potential exposure of this change in the law could cost the members of my organization $10 to $12 million a year. That cost will eventually be passed on to the taxpayers in the state of Minnesota.
The language in its existing form will result in protracted and expensive litigation, thereby having an adverse financial impact on counties, which will translate into additional costs for taxpayers. And I can just about tell you it's going to mean delayed benefits to those who you seek to help by virtue of the litigation that's going to be necessary to clarify some of these gray areas. I hope you're willing to consider our amendments to the language, and I thank you for this opportunity to share the concerns of the 450 public entities that I represent. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sykes. And Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Senator. I just wanted a question for Ms. Sykes. Were these concerns addressed to the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council? In other words, did they hear these concerns?
No. We are not party to the Work Comp Advisory Council.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. You did serve in the House with me for a while.
We are House members, former House members.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Sykes? Okay. Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And next we have Steve Hollander from the QRC. Welcome, Mr. Hollander, and if you could state your name and position for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Steve Hollander. With me is Deb Kirsten. We're both with the Minnesota Association of Rehabilitation Providers, and we're here to talk specifically about our concerns regarding the job development limitation part of this bill. I'm going to ask Ms. Kirsten to go first, if that's okay.
Sure. Ms. Kirsten, and if you could state your name as well.
Thank you. My name is Deborah Kirsten. I've worked as a job placement specialist in the workers' compensation system for 22 years, and I operate a small business here in Minnesota. In the Minnesota workers' compensation system, job placement services are provided to workers who have sustained injuries on the job. These workers have often done the same type of work all of their lives, such as manufacturing, union construction, nursing, education, law enforcement, to name a few. Job placement specialists in the system work proactively with injured workers to prepare them to job search in a very competitive labor market. One of the most valuable services that we provide is job development, and this entails generating job leads for our clients from cold calling, networking, and effectively written correspondence addressed not to whom it may concern, but to actual hiring managers at companies. This legislation would significantly restrict the provision of this key service to injured workers. What distinguishes an injured worker from all other job seekers includes that they're not transitioning to the same type of work that they've always done. They can't rely on their past work experience to get hired for a new job. The typical tools that are used by today's job seekers are ineffective for them. Consider a construction worker replacing $37 an hour whose only experience in job search is showing up at a union hall and waiting for her place in line, or an RN who can no longer perform CPR or lift more than 10 pounds. They have no experience looking for a new line of work, and they need job development assistance. We know how to help them find work, and we generate leads with the type of employers who will hire them. It takes hard work, time, and creativity to help an injured worker find the right fit. And the vocational rehab providers in this state do a very good job. We are one of the fastest return-to-work states in the country. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Minnesota, it takes an average of 8 months for a non-injured, unemployed worker to return to work. The injured workers who benefit most from this service, those with complicated restrictions, those with language barriers, workers with learning disabilities, individuals who are unable to retrain for a new line of work, they'll be cut off, and 3 to 6 months is just not enough time. The cost to provide services to injured workers is sustainable within the workers' compensation system. Cutting off services in this system will certainly enhance claims for unemployment, welfare, permanent total disability, and SSDI. This is an unnecessary expense to employers and taxpayers in this state. You've received a copy of some testimonials from injured workers who found a job with the assistance of someone like me. Quoting from Tommy, "I had a very high-paying union job until injuries prevented me from returning to work. My injuries required me to change a career, which is not easily accomplished in a short period of time. Just asking, please extend the job development services to 12 months. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kirsten. And Mr. Hollander. Excuse me. I guess there is a question to Senator Dames.
Yes, Mr. Chair. If I could have the young lady respond to my question. That being, how does that relate to the current language in the bill as far as these restrictions, as you might call them, or these limitations or time frame that we're setting?
Ms. Kirsten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How this relates is that in the language, it limits job placement services to 3 months, and then with the agreement of parties, 6 months, and then services are completely cut off for job development.
And Mr. Chair, follow up, how does that compare to the current rule, Ms. Kirsten?
There is no limitation.
Okay. Thank you.
And Senator Coonan.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Kirsten, did you, or probably more importantly, any of the people who received your services, have input with the Workers' Compensation Advisory Committee?
Ms. Kirsten.
That I'm aware of, no. No one in my community as a job placement specialist was consulted.
Any other questions? Mr. Hollander?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Steve Hollander. I want to thank you for allowing Ms. Kirsten and I to testify today. I promise to be very brief. I'm a QRC, Qualified Rehabilitation Consultant. I've been a QRC for 32 years. Over that time frame, I've worked with thousands of injured workers. My job is to help injured workers get back to work as fast as possible. I'm our professional association, MARP, legislative chairperson. I've had that role for 14 years. I'm also a member of the Rehabilitation Review Panel for the past 16 years. We're concerned about the job development limitation provision in the bill. The first thing I want to say, however, is that we have great respect for the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. We do not want to upend the Work Comp Advisory Council process. However, this time, on this particular issue, they simply got it wrong. 3 months of job development services, an additional six-month limitation, is simply not enough time to help injured workers return to work and new jobs. These people face many challenges beyond the challenges faced by able-bodied job seekers. We find that it normally takes far longer than 6 months for injured workers to find suitable employment. This proposal, to our knowledge, has not ever been vetted or studied. I don't think anyone can tell you with a degree of certainty that this has benefits for injured workers. We acknowledge, however, that sometimes job development services go on too long. We agree that there can be limits on job development services. What we are proposing is to make a small change in the provision, to change the three-month stop to a six-month stop, and then a hard limit of 12 months as opposed to the current hard limit of 6 months. This would allow injured workers the help they need to get back into the workforce. Vocational rehab costs and workers' compensation are very low in this state, about 3% of the total. Job development costs are about 1% of the total. Cutting off these services at 6 months will produce little cost savings but potentially significant harm. We also believe this proposal may actually increase costs to the workers' compensation system and the state. Injured workers who are left without help to find work will give up, perhaps file for permanent total disability, Social Security disability income, or other taxpayer-supported government programs. The Work Comp Advisory Council process is very important. Making this change will not harm that process. We're asking you to help us help injured workers get back to work. Please change the job development restriction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hollander. And Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Mr. Hollander, I have the same question for you that I did for Ms. Kirsten. Did you, or more importantly, any of the people who received your services have input with the Workmen's Compensation Advisory Committee?
No, we didn't.
Mr. Hollander.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. No, we didn't.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment that I will offer. I see there's one more testifier. I think we'll let the testifiers finish if that's okay with you. But I do have an amendment I would like to offer on this subject of job development services.
Sure. And we'll do that as soon as we are done with the testimony, Senator Coonan. So any other questions for either of our testifiers here? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Next, we have Susan Lauer from Minneapolis.
Some information I'd like to distribute.
Can you get it? Sure. Paige will pass that around for you.
Thank you.
And, welcome to the committee, Ms. Lauer. And if you could state your name and position for the committee, please.
My name's Susan Lauer. I'm here as a private citizen. I'm here out of concern for a provision in this bill. I am not a rehab provider. I'm not an injured worker. I don't stand to gain or lose in relation to this bill. However, I am particularly knowledgeable about workers' compensation, and I have long years of experience administering vocational rehab programs. So my concern is that limiting job development services will undermine a core purpose of the work comp system. The work comp system is supposed to provide reasonable, necessary medical treatment, provide wage loss benefits, and get people back to work. So anything that undermines the efforts to get people back to work seem puzzling to me. I can't picture a rationale for doing that. The proposed limit would impact the people who have the most serious injuries. These are the individuals who are unable to return to their date of entry job with their employer. They've typically been terminated by the employer. They're unable to return to their date of injury occupation due to the work injury. So these people are going to be out in this labor market competing for jobs. And what do we know about them? They have limited transferable skills. They have high permanent partial disabilities, meaning a loss of function. They are typically receiving temporary total disability benefits for over a year. And that's because they have medical issues to deal with, and they have difficulty competing in the labor market. You and I know people who have been looking for work in a labor market without a disability. It takes them more than a year in some cases. So these are the most seriously disabled individuals for whom services are going to be limited. There is no study that is produced that indicates that this is reasonable. There's no indication that injured workers who are precluded from doing their date of injury occupation are going to be able to get jobs in 3 months. There is no research to support that. So when this proposal is made, it's puzzling as to why it is proposed. We know that rehab services, when they go to completion, are very successful in Minnesota. In the 2010 Department of Labor Industry publication, it shows that 5,130 injured workers go back to work where the plan goes to completion. 98% of them go back to work. I'm going to give you an aside. When rehab plans do not go to completion, only 22% of them are working. That's a big problem in the system. And overall, what it means is there are 5,500 rehab plan terminations during a year. And out of that, where the plans don't go to completion, it drives down the return to work rate. It means that this work comp system is generating 2,500 unemployed disabled workers a year, every year. It's cranking out that number of injured workers. So do I think we should weaken the services to get people back to work? I don't see a rationale for that. There's already a dispute resolution forum where there are disputes about the cost, duration, or services in a rehab plan. Those are called rehab conferences at the Department of Labor and Industry. If an insurer is concerned about excessive costs. First of all, they don't need to pay the bill. Secondly, they can come in and request a rehab conference to address what are the reasonable services to be provided under a plan. So there's already a forum where there's concern about excess costs. It's available. It's easily available. So trying to figure out a rationale for limiting this important rehab service. I'm puzzled as to why it would be a cost argument. We know that the work comp system is a $1.3 billion system, a lot of money. And we know that rehab costs are 3%, and we know that job development and job placement services are 27%, which puts job development costs down at perhaps $6 million across 5,000 rehab plans in a year. And these services are crucial for people who have difficulty getting reemployed. They were all working at the date of injury. We know that. So the question is, shouldn't we facilitate a return to work for these individuals? And I don't understand why we would want to limit access to the important intervention services that can facilitate a return to work for those people with the most severe disabilities. I agree with previous people that this can result in cost shifting out of the work comp arena, where the work comp insurer has liability, into the taxpayer-funded systems. If these injured workers aren't employed, what are they going to do? They're going to look for income support help, medical support, use of other state-funded systems. So don't see how it's in the state's interest to limit access to those services that are significant in restoring people to an economic status that they would have enjoyed without disability. So those are my comments.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Lauer, and Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Senator Aiken. Ms. Lauer, you've provided pretty extensive information here and testimony. Have you had a background in this area, or do you work in this area? What's your experience here?
I've been asked by my employer to not answer the question about where I work.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Lauer.
But I have extensive experience in workers' compensation and in vocational rehab.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, again, thank you, Ms. Lauer. And our next testifier is Sarah Roebling, a former senator. Welcome back. If you could state your current position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Claire Roebling, and I'm the Communications and Legislative Coordinator for Scott County. And I just asked to be on the agenda this morning after coming from the other bodies hearing on this bill and not hearing testimony that we received so eloquently from Ms. Sykes. They apparently ran out of time, and I was very concerned that the issues that she brought forward be put forward to the committee, because I think they're very important. First of all, we do have concerns that the public employers have no seat at the table on the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. And yet, as we heard Ms. Sykes say, 384,000 employees are affected through public employees. And it's a big number. And certainly, this particular proposal, especially about the PTSD, may have a greater impact on public employees than the private employees because of the types of work that public employees perform. We have the corrections, we have the police officers, the firefighters, the paramedics, social workers, who in the normal course of their jobs may see and experience some things that most workers would not. And some of them may be troubling, and some of them may be extraordinarily troubling. And I guess one of the concerns we have is that we would think that the extraordinarily troubling issues would be most likely to cause the PTSD. But it is hard to determine how an incident affects any individual person. But we also have concerns about who's going to determine how the PTSD began. You know, what is the root cause of it? What level it is? Is it a level where they will be able to continue working and maybe receive some counseling, or will they be able to go basically on a disability type of it would become a disability type of a case for some time or extended time. You know, we did hear testimony in the other committee that the police, for example, right now allow up to a year of leave if they have been shot at or had shot someone and they have some mental trauma because of that. It's my understanding that this would supersede that. This is state law, obviously, and that it, you know, so they had very strict parameters around this. What types of incidents would trigger a possible leave or treatment? And it would have been rather extraordinary. That doesn't happen in most officers' line of duty on a regular basis, certainly. And so I guess that's what we're concerned about is what are the parameters around the definition? Who gets to determine it? I do appreciate the addition of the psychiatrist and taking the regular medical doctor maybe out of the equation for an actual diagnosis for a mental disorder. Because in the past, we always had, they treated mental disorders that were tied to physical disorders, but this will have a standalone as a mental disorder. And they are. We know they're harder to diagnose. And there is parameters around it that are coming out from the medical community. And we are supposed to, according to this, use the most recent diagnosis. But there are questions and concerns, and we just wanted to make sure that some of those were addressed before the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Roebling. And any questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Oh, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Senator. I actually have a question for Senator Sparks, if we're on part of the hearing yet.
Sure. Senator Sparks. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Senator Aiken. Senator Sparks, you know, this is kind of interesting. I always take great stock in the advisory councils, and I know that particularly this advisory council, the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, usually does a very thorough job with its recommendations, and I know they're very tenuous sometimes in the agreements. And I wrote down what Commissioner Iden said, which I thought was a very good quote, which is something along the line of, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And so I'm keeping that in mind as I'm thinking about my vote here today. But there are two things. In the opposition, the testifiers who testified with concerns about this bill, certainly as a taxpayer myself and representing my taxpayers up here, I do believe that there were some significant questions left from Ms. Roebling's and Ms. Sykes' testimony about PTSD and expanding that. So I'm wondering, and then the other thing I would say is, let me ask you this first question. Is there an avenue to address these concerns after the passage of this bill?
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I think that obviously this committee has jurisdiction over workers' comp issues, so I think that's why we're having this discussion here today. I would agree with you wholeheartedly that I think the work of the Workers' Comp Advisory Council is very important. Obviously, I've been here for 10 years, and many of you have served in the House. I think that if we listen to history and allow that to happen, before this council was put into place, there was some very heated debate on both the House and Senate floor, depending on which party was in charge, and so I think that is important. I would also say that obviously we just had a change in the legislature. I was added to the Workers' Comp Advisory Council as well as Senator John Peterson, a Republican member. We didn't have a lot of time to do this negotiations, obviously, because we're busy here in session. But having said that, I think that when the first recommendations came out, the Chamber and Business went back, renegotiated some of those things, and brought back some ideas and reforms that dealt with some of these very issues. And I think that as former Senator Roebling and the gal from the counties talked about, this post-traumatic stress disorder is a big thing. And I think we did move by taking away some of the good faith language and changing some of the other language to help those folks out. So I just think we have to be careful. Obviously, the bill would go to the floor, and I can certainly check with my committee administrator. It might have to go to rules because it is a late bill. As the deputy commissioner did say, they tried to work on the bill and get the negotiated language in front of us, but it didn't happen in time. So there is still time, but obviously we'll leave up to the committee to decide what they want to do. And I think it would be fair, too. I know that Senator Coonan has an amendment, and before we move on that, I think it would be nice to hear from maybe Mr. Leto and Mr. Gerber from the chamber to have them acknowledge what happened during those negotiations, if that helps at all, Senator Nelson.
Thank you.
Okay, great. And we have also Senator Dames had a question as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks, this bill did come in after the deadline. So the decision to hear the bill, should that have not have traveled through rules first in order to get the decision to have this bill heard?
And Senator Sparks, I guess the answer is no, is what I'm being told by counsel here. But Senator Sparks, if you wanted to.
Go ahead, Senator Dames.
And Senator Dames.
So will it go? Will it get? Will it ever go to rules?
Okay, and that's normal procedure, I guess, to move it to rules. And
from here.
Okay. We just move it, and then it automatically gets sucked into rules because it's a late bill.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Sure.
When this
Senator
gets
Dames.
Taken to rules, will this be prior to going to the floor, or where will this? Okay, so then it go from here to rules.
That's correct.
So then, with that said, Mr. Chair, what's the possibility of this being recommended to move forward without a recommendation, pointing out some of our issues and hoping that that can be worked on by all parties involved by the time it goes to rules? Would you be in favor of something like that?
And Senator Sparks.
Chair and Senator Dames, I think we can have that discussion. And I think, like I said, I think we should hear a little bit from the folks that negotiated dealing with that post-traumatic stress disorder as well as the QRCs. I've been continuing to meet with those folks, and I think that's fair to let them respond, and then we'll see what the committee would like to do here today.
Okay. Mr. And, Chair. Yes, and Senator Rood.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sparks, can you tell me, I see that the workers' compensation, the council is composed of 6 representatives from business and 6 from labor, and yet we just heard that there's 384,000 public employees that are not represented by this council. Is there a way for those people to have a seat at the table? I mean, that's a considerably large group.
Who represents the
public? Mr. Chair,
my name
is Brad Leto, Chief of Staff for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, an alternate for President Knutson on the Advisory Council. The public employees that are represented by AFSCME Council 5, AFSCME Council 65, nurses, SEIU, I'm missing other folks, and I apologize. But anyways, they are all part of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, are represented on the Minnesota AFL-CIO General Board, and voted unanimously, including all of those representatives, numerous representatives from those unions on the General Board, 75-member General Board, supported the bill. I think the rub from the counties and the cities or whoever is that, because they're self-insured, that it's a cost to them to increase benefits. Understanding, though, that benefits, the maximum hasn't been increased since 2008. The COLA has not been increased since 1995, or has not had any kind of adjustment whatsoever since 1995. And the new thing, of course, is the psychological only or mental provision. We did, did make some changes to that, not all of the changes that they want. I believe every other state, 34 states that have a real restrictive version of psychological only or a wide open version of psychological only, we would be, with this language, which was provided by the business representatives and the insurance community, which we accepted, would be the top four restrictive in the state. We'd probably be on par with the state of Utah. The states around us that have a mental provision have a much more liberal mental provision, and that includes Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, Iowa. North and South Dakota do not have those provisions. I can certainly let Mr. Gerber respond to that. Also, I do have comments on the job search issue as well. As far as people not contact, I mean, the various folks, I said we didn't contact them. The advisory council meetings are open. Also, people over the years have never been afraid to call our office to talk about issues. In fact, we did have a meeting with the QRCs in our office, which previously, and I can go through that history, but previously supported the 6 month and these other issues on job search. Actually did tell us this session, and we talked about it, that they had changed their mind and did not support that anymore. And this was from years ago. This was from 2008 when it was supported by four QRCs, four labor members, and four employer representatives on a workers' compensation vocational rehab council, and then decided that they no longer support it. So full disclosure on that. Anyways, I can go further on that if you'd like.
And Senator Rood.
Well, Mr. Chair, so can you just answer the question, are the 384,000 public employees represented or not?
Mr. Lato.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rood, through our organization, the ones that are unionized, yes.
Okay, so.
Senator Rood.
And Mr. Chair, so I guess I'm confused. We have someone saying that they have not been represented in this process, and you're saying that they have been represented in this process. So,
Mr. Chair,
just
Senator
clarify
Rood,
that for me.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Rood. The ones that they are not all unionized. I want to be clear on that they are not all unionized employees. The ones that are unionized, represented by all of the public employee unions that I mentioned, plus additional ones. They are representative through their elected representatives, democratically elected representatives, on the Minnesota AFL-CIO General Board. The ones that are not unionized, I cannot speak to.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. So if you could state your name for the record, please.
My name is Benjamin Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Chair, Senator Rood, I think I want to be clear. So the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce represents the employer community. And so we represent our members. There's six. There's also a self-employed or self-insured member on the council as well. So there is a representative on the council that is self-insured. But as far as I think Senator Roebling's concerns about specifically some of the public sector employers, they don't have an actual seat on the council. I think that was your question.
Okay. Thank you.
And Senator Dames, did you have a question?
The question was answered.
Okay. Any other? Mr. Gerber, did you want to make a statement at all?
Just briefly, thank you to Brad and Sharon, Laura and David. I mean, this was an extensive negotiation, and I think Brad pointed out with the mental provision. I mean, we worked very hard on that. So, thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Nelson.
Just a final comment. I take great credibility in what this advisory council does. I know it's difficult, and I appreciate the fact that you've been able to come up with a good document. Might not be perfect, I understand that, but I appreciate the fact that it's good. And I will say that I am a little troubled, though, by this I just want to, as legislators, one of the things that we need to do is we need to be very astute to conflicts of interest and understanding point of view. And so I just have to say that I'm a little disappointed that the last testifier who gave one of the last testifiers gave a lengthy presentation, but then said that for some reason she couldn't divulge whom she worked for. And I just so with that, I can't take much credibility in that. And so, but I am very much
in support of the advisory council, and I encourage you to continue working through particularly the PST piece for our counties and our local units of government. But I just appreciate, Senator Sparks, what you've done and the council, and I know it's not always easy. And so thank you for putting together a good document for us.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Coonan.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment I have is the A2 amendment, and it addresses the issues brought up by Mr. Hollander and Ms. Kirsten. And what this does is lengthen out the time that the job development services would be available. Before I get into that, Mr. Chairman, the amendment was drafted to the bill before it was amended, so I would like the help of Mr. Fuller to do what's necessary to the amendment to make it fit in the bill as amended.
Okay, and Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, the amendment was drafted to the amendment, actually, and so all you have to do is strike on, if you're looking at the A2 amendment, strike the language on line one says the SCS 1603A1 amendment 2, because that is now part of the bill. So we're actually amending Senate file number 1603 as follows, then in just in parentheses, but you don't have to write this. The page and line references are to the A1 amendment, so which is now part of the bill. So it'll all work out.
Okay.
All right.
Senator Coonan could just.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Fuller. Okay, what the amendment does is for the job development services for injured workers, moves the initial check to 26 weeks from 13 weeks and moves a cutoff from 52 weeks from 26 weeks. And I think it's important to remember that in current law there's no deadlines at all. And so what this does is lengthen the limitation in time service can be provided in this bill from 6 months to 12 months in the end. This is something that's kind of important, I think, with those shorter time frames. The more seriously injured workers are still working on health issues rather than job, considering the next job if they have to make some changes in employment. For someone who cannot find a job, of course, there's a possibility of the disability settlement from workers' comp being greater, and also the possibility that somewhere down the road these individuals could end up getting services from government, and so there's potential of a greater cost. I actually see this as a way to try and save some of those future larger costs. But that's basically what the amendment does, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be interested in comments from other members.
Sure. And discussions to the amendment. Senator Dames.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the amendment goes the right direction. I do have some concerns. Those concerns being knowing that this document that we're dealing with today has taken some time to get to the stage it's at today. And if this amendment passes, I'm not so sure what that's going to do to the document we have, as far as I don't think that amendment is going to be that easily adopted by the council. I guess what I would like to see is when we move this bill forward, that the issue that this amendment deals with be noted as an issue that needs to be worked out between all the players. The issue of the good faith needs to be worked out, and the issue dealing with extraordinary and unusual circumstances as compared to normal conditions needs to be dealt with. And I guess versus doing an amendment, I would like to see all three of those included in the language when we pass the bill out of here, so that stuff gets dealt with by the players before we get to the next committee. That would be my recommendation, but people can do as they see fit.
Okay. And Senator Coonan?
Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I would like to have the author of the bill, Senator Sparks, comment on Senator Dames' idea.
Sure. And Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Dames and Senator Coonan, I mean, I think we're going kind of down two roads. I can speak a little bit to your amendment and obviously to Senator Dames. Senator Dames, the only problem that I would have with your idea, not that it's not a good idea to continue to work on those good faith, the QRC issues, is that, as you know, tomorrow's May 1st. It's going to get tougher and tougher around here to try to schedule hearing times. I think this has been a priority of both the chamber and labor. As I said, over 20 years for them to come to these recommendations. I think we can continue to have those discussions. I'm just fearful that if we lay the bill on the table or don't take action, the clock's ticking. I know many of us are going to get busier and busier. With regards to Senator Coonan's amendment, and he did speak to me about it, and obviously I've had discussions and many talks with the folks from the QRC. It kind of goes back to something that Senator Nelson said, too. I think that we just have to be very careful if we start going down this road of opening up negotiations that the Work Comp Council has done, because depending on what party is in power, it can get kind of tough. For those of you that don't think that I'm supportive of injured workers, I can tell you there's nothing farther than the truth. I know that when Senator Metzen chaired the job committee, I worked really hard with former Commissioner Swigum to try to help an injured worker that was hurt at the Hormel plant in Austin, Minnesota. My dad was a union card holder there for 42 and a half years to get an ombudsman put in place to try to help those folks out. I hope that there's still a way that we can help these guys, but I'm just a little fearful if we start to open up these negotiations. And as Deputy Commissioner said, there's 13 other sections in the bill that are pretty good. And sometimes I think that's probably a pretty good negotiation when either side is really happy, but that's kind of where I think we're at. And obviously I'll let some more of the guys that negotiated the overall recommendations speak to it as well.
Any other questions? Senator Nelson?
I get just a quick comment that I agree with Senator Sparks wholeheartedly on this. As far as the credibility of the council and the tenuous nature of these type of agreements. And this is a pretty significant amendment. It doubles. And I would be very cautious about, while it might be something to look at, I don't know that this is the forum right here at this table. I'd feel very uncomfortable with that, not having been a part of the negotiations that were so critical to this bill.
Okay. And Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Sparks. Just for the record, I'm not suggesting that we put the bill on the table, not by any means. I think we need to move the bill forward. I was just asking to move it forward and that we discuss those issues between now and it goes to the next committee. Give an opportunity for those folks to work on your indifferences and see what comes out. I realize there may not be changes or may be changes, but I'm just asking for these folks to have one more opportunity to try to work out their indifferences. And if we're going to go to another committee, hopefully there will be time to do that. But I'm not asking to table the bill. No.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate your comments.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Nelson, you commented that this doubles. It doubles what's in the bill. Current law, there's no limits at all, so it's still restricting from current law. But you're right, it does double what the language that's in the bill. Just wanted to clarify that. I think this is a very important issue. Of course, I offered the amendment, but I also can count, and I can see how everything is going to work here. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to withdraw the amendment, but that doesn't mean that I don't think this is very important. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay. And so Senator Coonan withdraws the A2 amendment. And next, there is one other amendment. Senator Sparks, the A3 amendment. Is that it? Oh, that's okay. So, okay. Any further discussion to the bill as amended? Seeing none, Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair, I really do appreciate the discussion we've had here on Senate File 1603. These issues are never easy, as you can see, which is why we do have the advisory council. Work comp is an agreement between employees and employers to help the injured workers. And it is reasonable that they work together negotiating changes to the system. So I think that they deserve a lot of credit. I know it wasn't easy, and obviously for the members of this committee it wasn't easy. We'll continue to have those discussions to see if we can make the bill better before it gets through the Rules Committee or to the floor for final passage. With that, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 1603 as amended be recommended.
Okay. Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 1603 as amended be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Dames.
Senator Sparks, does that are you agreeing then that we need to try to work out these other issues before it goes to the next committee?
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, obviously my door is always open. I believe that these folks that have issues with it can certainly contact either Brad or Ben or Shar or David and continue to have those discussions. You have my word on that.
Thank you.
Okay, once again, Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 1603 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.